In the next episode, not this one, we'll examine how science fiction has taken on the challenge of imagining life after global warming. There's drought, flood, grievous loss, and even some optimism. So, with that in mind, we thought we'd whet your appetite for annihilation by replaying this interview I did with author Ben Winters a few years back. In his trilogy, The Last Policeman, it isn't the slow creep of melting glaciers and devastating drought that heralds the end of the world. It's an asteroid. All the action takes place in the six final months before the date of impact, which spurs responses ranging from frolicking on beaches to suicide to murder. But the central character in Winter's trilogy is a policeman who just wants to do his job. Early on, there's a bidding war over which news show gets dibs on the final announcement. In Winter's book, CBS newsman Scott Pelley wins the ultimate, and I do mean ultimate, get. The scientist with the terminal calculation.
Pelley leans forward, all empathy, asks the magically stupid question that all the world needed to hear. So then, Doctor, what are our options? Dr. Leo Tolkien trembling, almost laughing. Options? There are no options. And then Tolkien just keeps talking, babbling, really, about how sorry he is on behalf of the world's astronomical community, how they had studied every realistic scenario, but this never could have been imagined. An object with such a near perihelion, with such an epically long elliptical period, such a staggeringly large object. The odds of such an object's existence so vanishingly low. And Scott Pelley is staring at him, and all over the world, people are sinking into grief or hysteria. Because all at once, there was no more ambiguity, no more doubt. Odds of impact 100%. October 3rd. No options. Many people remained glued to their televisions after the program ended, watching pundits and professors of astronomy and political figures stammering and weeping. Many people ran to the phones to try to reach loved ones, though all the circuits were jammed and would remain that way for the week that followed. Other people went out into the streets, bitter January weather notwithstanding, to commiserate with neighbors or strangers, or to engage in small acts of vandalism or petty mischief. I, personally, turned off the TV and went to work.
I was in my fourth week as the detective. I had an arson case I was working on.
It's busy.
That's obviously a turning point. From then on, more and more people start drifting away from life as they'd lived it, and they cease going through the motions. But not this guy. What is the deal with Hank Pallas?
Well, Hank is a dedicated lawman. I mean, this is all he ever wanted to do. Since he was a little kid, he really wanted to be a cop, and he believes in justice and law enforcement. The idea that the world is coming to an end is obviously upsetting, but for him, he doesn't understand why that means he shouldn't do the job that he was sort of put here to do. A couple times over the course of the trilogy, he expresses this to people. Well, why shouldn't we all just keep on doing what we're supposed to be doing? The asteroid isn't here yet. The thing that makes most sense is for everyone to stay the course because then it can't affect us until it actually gets here.
He's already doing the main thing on his bucket list. And if everybody in life were doing what they wanted to do, there would be no unraveling.
Which I think Hank would admit. Most people aren't fortunate enough to be doing something in life that they can feel dedicated to. If your job is, you know, sweeping up somewhere, then it's probably harder to justify continuing doing it when the world is unraveling around you. I tried to, over the course of the trilogy, think about all the different ways that people would react to this death that is far away but getting closer every day.
It's very persuasive. Another very persuasive part of the book is how you depict the technological unraveling, how the global communications that tied everybody together begin to fray.
You know, that's interesting. And the passage that you asked me to read there, that was my major media event. The last time on Earth, there's one of these things where it's going to be on TV, everybody's going to be watching it, which in real life is happening less and less frequently, that there is one big thing that everybody cares about. But at the beginning of the first book, the world is still close enough to the world that we inhabit that I could, I think, realistically do a scene like that, where everyone's been watching the asteroid get closer on the internet or in TV specials. When it first shows up, it's in that zany news category, mm-hmm. you know, where it shows up on your homepage, a news of the weird kind of thing. But then it gets closer and closer. I do this mainstream media event. Pretty early on, the internet starts to get spotty, and then eventually it blinks out. Because the internet requires people at work. So when people start to drift off and go into their bucket list adventures and disappear into their bunkers, those kinds of massive infrastructural systems start to fall apart. And I show that with the water. I show it with electricity. And there's a scene about halfway through the second book where my protagonist, he's on a college campus, which has turned into this utopian anarchic society. And he's sitting next to this kid, and he notices that the kid has got his iPhone out. Just keeps taking it out and running his thumb over it over and over and over again, yeah. as if by some magic it's going to turn on.
We would continue to feel them like the famous amputated limbs, you
I
know?
Think that's totally true, Brooke. It's like, it's a part of us.
And then when you get to the third book, things have really come apart. There is a complete lack of information, and as always happens in the real world, conspiracy theories rush in to fill the gap. Hank's sister is fully committed to belief in a conspiracy that there is a way to blow up the asteroid, a way to avert disaster.
The whole idea with his sister, with Nico, and the role that she plays in the trilogy, besides the sort of emotional dynamic between the two of them, and they're very close and very protective of each other, but they take basically opposite points of view toward the coming apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Pallas, he just wants to keep doing his job. He trusts the scientists. He trusts the government. He trusts the mainstream media. He believes that this is happening. And therefore, there's nothing to be done about it. It's just a matter of waiting. Nico, on the other hand, becomes involved in this sort of shadowy and complicated conspiracy to either prove the asteroid isn't real or to stop the asteroid. Part of that for me was another representation of the self-selected media consumption age that we're in, where it's very easy to find an infinite amount of confirmation of your feeling or belief and to more or less avoid or condemn anything that would be contrary to your belief.
Right.
So it seems to me that if a government scientist came on television and said that an asteroid was going to be here in 6 months and would destroy all of life, that a lot of people would say, no way. And I'm going to spend the rest of my time on Earth proving that that's not true.
It isn't just that she's naive. She's chosen a way to face the end of the world that makes her feel that her last moments on Earth matter. And you could certainly argue that Hank's don't. His first homicide involves what looks like a suicide. And given that so many people are committing suicide and they only have 6 months left anyway, what is the difference?
It doesn't matter if the world is coming to an end. It doesn't matter what the context is. This is a murder victim, and he deserves the same justice under the law that everybody does. If I believe in the rule of law, then I believe in it all the time, forever.
Right. He's a moral absolutist, and his sister is in her way, too. And in the midst of these siblings finding their way to live their lives, you have the echoes of the past. Hank and a colleague at a police precinct in Ohio.
Yeah. So they're at this police station, and they find this old radio device. And Hank, it starts broadcasting a message. Here, I'll read about it, too. I'm remembering the same console at Concord PD. It was rendered obsolete by the digital laptop systems that were installed a couple years before I took the oath. And it sat there in the corner, black and shiny and immovable, a monument to traditional police work. The message coming out of the rotary radio command says, first aid centers have been established in the following communities. First aid centers have been established in the following communities. And then the lady starts to list them. Good old-fashioned Norman Rockwell town names. Conesville, Zanesville, Davola. We stand there side by side, Cortez and I, listening to the charmless recital of town names. It is creating this low, wistful feeling in my heart, the woman's voice, the drone of the machine, and I think it may simply be that I miss information. For most of my life, the world was awash with news, with reports of things happening. And then, in the last year, they blipped off the radar, one by one. The Concord Monitor and the New York Times, and then television, the whole concept of television, and the internet with its ceaseless froth and churn, all of it just gone.
The reason why I wanted you to read that section is that over the course of the three books, the background noise gets quieter and quieter and quieter up to the penultimate moment. And he's in a place he never would have imagined he would be, with people he never would have imagined he would ever know, doing what he never would imagine he would ever do. And I just wonder, when you think about the quiet that inhabits the world at that time, I mean, there's an ineffable sadness, but is there also a sense of, I don't know, completion somehow?
Well, to be honest, as I was writing it, there was something a little appealing about saying, what must it feel like to again have that kind of quiet? I guess it's a little bit of a shame that it took an approaching asteroid to achieve that. But as you say, there's something attractive about it, a peace. You almost mourn for it.
But you'd never give up the internet.
Well, you know, you got to check your email.
Why'd you write this book?
Well, if I'm totally honest, the initial impulse was, what is a really, really interesting way of telling a detective story, right? Like, what if there is this massive object coming? It's going to destroy civilization, but I've got a guy who's still trying to solve a crime. I sort of said, aha. But I think very quickly, Brooke, as I was writing it, I realized that I had kind of sort of stumbled onto something that was more meaningful. And the truth is, I think what I found ultimately was a story about how all of us choose to order our lives, given the fact that there's some kind of asteroid coming for all of us. That's what life is. This is not an original thought, but it's interesting to think about how in our day and age, we make the choices we make. How do we go about our lives in a way that feels satisfying? And there are a lot of different answers to that question. You know, you take the expression, you only live once, and it's easy to interpret that to mean, so we should do whatever we want and have a lot of fun. Or you can interpret that to mean, so one must live as uprightly and in the service of other people as one can. I don't know what the answer is, but it was certainly engaging for me to investigate a lot of different answers as I went through this story. The thing about Hank is that he can't stop working. And at the beginning of the books, he comes off as heroic for that reason. You know, he's the man who cares when nobody else does, which is a pretty old trope in crime writing. And I think I've given it something of a new spin. He cares when nobody else does, but there's a really good reason that other people don't care. Mm-hmm. But by the end of the last book, his dedication, his sense of needing to keep working no matter what, it starts to feel less heroic and a little bit more like madness.
Like his sister.
Yeah. Like, you just have to believe in something. You have to.
But at the end, he has to give it up. He runs out the string.
Yeah, he runs out the string. That's right.
Now, is your trilogy called The Last Policeman? Do you have an overall name, like Song of Fire and Ice?
No, I wish. That would be catchy. No, it's just called The Last Policeman Trilogy.
Okay.
You know what? I take it back. It's called The Song of Fire and Ice. That's, I like that.
That's good. It was a great book, Ben. Thank you so much.
Oh, man, thank you so much. I was so happy to get your guys' email.
Ben Winters is the author most recently of Underground Airlines. I spoke to him in 2014 about his trilogy, The Last Policeman. Join us for the upcoming episode of On the Media, which is all about imagining our final days. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.